Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the $400 billion 30-year gas deal Russia and China signed at an Asian security summit in Shanghai, where China's leader called for a new regional alliance involving China, Russia, and Iran that excludes the United States. One of the most quoted analysts on energy issues, Fidel Gate, Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company, joins us to discuss Putin's move to diversify Russia's oil and gas markets as a hedge against possibly ramped-up sanctions from the EU and US in response to a further Russian encroachment on Ukrainian territory following Russia's annexation of Crimea. Then we'll look into the real scandal in Libya, not the absurd Republican sideshow over Benghazi, but the current chaos that is a result of the US and NATO removing the Gaddafi regime via a bombing campaign, then walking away from the rubble, declaring victory as Islamist militias moved in to fill the void in a broken country without an army or a police force. Ali Abdelatif Ahmida, the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England and author of The Libya We Do Not Know, joins us to discuss the role of General Khalifa Haftar and his self-declared Libyan National Army that is taking on the Islamist militias backed by U.S. allies Turkey and Qatar. Then finally, we'll assess the wisdom of the House Democrats' decision to join in the political theater of what will be the eighth investigation into the Benghazi incident, this time by a House Select Committee headed by Congressman Trey Gowdy, who has already indicated he is out to prosecute the Obama administration rather than shed new light on the tragic deaths of a U.S. ambassador and three others. Paul Waldman, a contributing editor for The American Prospect, joins us to discuss the choice of the five Democrats who will be up against seven Republicans likely to be grandstanding in an election year unless they actually come up with something that resembles evidence of White House or State Department misdeeds. And joining us now is Fidel Gate, who is the Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company in New York City. Mr. Gate has had more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research and has previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company in New York. He is one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fidel Gate.
Thank you for having me.
And this deal that was signed between China and Russia that apparently is worth about $400 billion. But from what I understand, the Chinese essentially had Putin over a barrel. He was desperate to make a deal. The details of this deal aren't known, but is it your impression that China got the best of Russia?
Yes, I assume because of the situation, the main outlet for the Russian gas is Europe. And with all the political tension and fear of sanctions, he wanted to go to the safer side, and that is China. But in all honesty, it's like jumping from the frying pan into the fire. The Chinese are not going to take it easy on him. They want to drive a hard bargain, and that's exactly what happened. They drove a hard bargain, and they probably got gas at a steep discount from what the Russian gas export to Western Europe is.
But it is the fact that the deal or the amount of gas that they're going to be supplying China, 38 billion cubic meters of gas annually, which represents about a quarter of China's current annual gas consumption of nearly 150 billion cubic meters. So they already signed up for a quarter of the market, right?
Correct. Which is obviously it's longer term, it's really a win-win situation for both Russia and China. China desperately needs to have natural gas in their fuel mix because the problem, the environmental problem that they have with coal, they're going to cost them billions and billions of dollars for health and cleanup and things like that. So for them, that is a window of opportunity. They took advantage of it. And it's a long-term deal. It will require a huge amount of investment, and it will take years to really come to a full speed.
Well, apparently it's going to cost Russia $55 billion, and it's going to cost China at least $20 billion. I take it that's to build the pipelines. And so this is a situation where You've got the, what, 2018 is before the gas is going to flow? Is that your understanding?
Well, at least it will take 5 years. It depends, because this is not an easy area to build the pipeline. It has obviously not flat land. It goes through different time zones. And also, you have bad weather in most cases that will delay the construction. It's not going to go according to plan. It's likely to be behind schedule and over the original budget.
But apparently, from what we know, the plans call for building the pipeline to link China's northeast to a line that carries gas from Western Siberia to the Pacific port of Vladivostok.
Right.
And my understanding is that once Russia has established that infrastructure, it would also be able to open up its markets to Japan and South Korea.
That is the goal, the long-term goal, but to outside of China, they will need LNG, and LNG costs a lot of money. We saw what happened with Chevron LNG facility in Australia. It cost $50 billion. And I guarantee you, the Russians or the Chinese, they try to build one, it costs probably more than that. They don't have experience in LNG plans. So it is very steep price tag for these facilities. It's not going to be easy.
So again, I'm speaking with Fidel Gait, who is a senior vice president for oil and gas research with Oppenheimer & Company in New York. Mr. Gait has more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research and has previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company in New York. And he's one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. So back to Putin and the extent to which he needed this deal, and the details of it, of course, have not been disclosed, so we don't know how much he had to compromise. But what's your sense then of how he's navigating between his geopolitical ambitions in the West and the possibility of creating a backlash in the West? The Germans are sort of caught in between the U.S. and Russia to some extent, because they're dependent upon natural gas from Russia. What's your reading on the broader landscape in the west of Russia?
So far, Putin has won. So far, the West has lost. There is no common purpose or vision. There is no really effective leadership. It is every man for himself. Germany depends on Russian oil and gas. Germany is the largest importer of both. And obviously, Germany is the third largest economy in the world. And if the German economy stumbles, so would be the rest of Europe. So the European is very careful in trying to push for more sanctions. The U.S. is unhappy, but the U.S. has not really shown any leadership on this front. We just talk. We never really took any action. And but so far, Putin has won. If I keep a score, he is definitely ahead of the U.S. and European. Now, having said that, this is not the first time that Germany is being threatened by supply cutoff and disruption. It happened 3 or 4 years ago when the same situation between Russia and the Ukraine ended up. The Ukraine basically took the gas that was supposedly shipped to Germany because it's the same pipeline that carries the same gas. So Germany has prior warning and experience with potential disruption of the gas flow from Russia, and I'm very surprised that Germany has not made, say, a being diversified in terms of energy sources and not put their eggs in one basket. I'm very surprised that they have not done that or have not acted, that they are planning to do that anytime soon.
So they, as a result of the last cutoff in Ukraine, they pushed forward with the Nord Stream pipe. So they have a direct pipeline to Russia. So they're not subject to any tensions or breakdown of between Russia and Ukraine.
But in a way, they made themselves hostage to Russia, basically, because it is their supply chain. If push comes to shove and the German government, say, took a harder line against Russia, all Russia has to do is to shut off the gas and really destroy the German economy. So I'm not sure it's going to reach this point, but at least Putin carries a very big stick, and he doesn't have to use it. But, the other countries will know that he is not bashful. He can use it anytime.
Well, one of the ironies that I understand, Fat Algate, is that the huge debt that Ukraine owes Russia for the gas consumed so far, reaching into $2 to $3 billion, there's a real possibility that the West and even the U.S. may end up paying that bill. So here we are at the end of the day, our money's going to go into Putin's coffers.
Correct. Well, as I said, I really don't blame Putin. I blame the West. I blame the U.S. We've never had any energy strategy coordinated or standalone. Now the Europeans are exposed. The U.S. is basically kind of lost. We don't really know what to do to push for economic sanctions, that the Europeans are not going to support us or to do it alone, and that basically would become, ineffective. So far, Putin has won, and unfortunately is getting away with murder. So
how long would it take, though, to diversify supplies? The southern European countries like Italy could get more gas from Libya or even from Qatar, couldn't they?
Correct. But again, they have not prepared themselves for that. Mm-hmm. And the Germans have not prepared themselves. If they start and put it on an accelerated schedule, it's going to be years. It's not going to be months. It will require billions of dollars of investment, and it will take many years to do. But it can be done, and it should be done, because, again, Putin cannot be trusted. And I'm not sure the person after him can be trusted either.
Well, what I find extraordinary, Fat Algate, is that Putin has already moved one step ahead by covering his bets by having an alternative market in China.
Exactly.
And yet the West hasn't, and Europe in particular, hasn't hedged its bets by trying to look at LNG and Qatar and other countries as alternatives to their dependence on Russia.
Exactly. So he is a planner. And we are basically reactionaries. We have not been able to see through him. He basically used the Winter Olympics as a camouflage or a cover to pull off his plot, and he did. And it was a surprise to the people in the West, but now people are beginning to see it the way I see it, is that has been planned for all along.
So you're saying that he used the Sochi Winter Olympics as a cover?
Correct.
Meaning what? That he distracted?
Well, his intention that, he was spending all this time skating and scoring, goals and hockey matches and all these things, and smiling and doing all this thing, while his machinery and his military was already preparing for the invasion of Crimea and eastern Ukraine. This development did not happen overnight. It's not a spontaneous reaction by the masses. It's not. That was all part of a bigger plan. I would go back 4 or 5 years ago, actually more than 5 years ago, when George Bush was president and when Putin did the same thing with Georgia. I mean, he's trying, that was basically a preview. Ukraine is a much bigger fish to fry, and he basically had the Georgian situation to prepare him for the bigger jump, and he finally did. So Ukraine, for all practical purposes, is history. I think Russia will annex Eastern Ukraine. A lot of people are beginning to think that that is done deal. And I blame the Ukrainian government, basically, because they are very corrupt, very incompetent, and infighting. And that is an opening that Putin took advantage of.
So what is then the role, or how much is the U.S.'s fracking independence of its becoming the world's biggest producer of natural gas very quickly and becoming more and more self-sufficient? That's being touted as having all kinds of geopolitical implications and putting the United States in the catbird seat. You're telling us the opposite. So explain what the...
It's very simple. We have no energy policy. We don't have strategy. We have all the natural resources, but we really don't have the right management and the right vision to take us to the next step. What can we do with the surplus gas that we have? Nothing. We have not done anything. If we accelerated building a supply facility chain, basically LNG facilities in the U.S., to take gas to Europe, we would not have been in this situation. If we left the ban, the oil export ban, it will immediately bring down oil prices, will immediately put pressure on Putin. If we go and ask our friend in the Persian Gulf, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, all these countries, I mean, we provide them military protection and everything else, and this is the time that they show that they are reciprocating. Saudi Arabia can increase its oil export by 1 million barrels a day in 4 weeks. They can have a stopgap measure. They can basically replace big chunk of Russian oil going to Europe. And then for all practical purposes, Putin will not be able to sell his oil at fair price in the market, and he will have to accept discount, like the Iranians doing right now, because of the economic sanctions are hurting them. So they have to go to the secondary market, if you will. So that will happen, you know, if we have an energy policy, if we have a coordinated strategy. Now we know how important energy is. Putin is playing the energy card. And the U.S. is a much bigger country when it comes to energy resources, and we can play this card even better. But unfortunately, he does a better job than we do.
So when Senator McCain rather contemptuously refers to Russia as not a country but a gas station, what's he saying there?
Which is true. I mean, if you strip oil and gas out of Russia, Russia becomes a third world country. They have no export of anything whatsoever except armament, you know, arms, oil and gas. That's it.
Mm-hmm. So, but when you talk about the U.S. organizing, let's assume that, as you pointed out, that it's very likely that Putin will annex the east of Ukraine, and then the U.S. and the West will be forced to impose sanctions. They've already made the threats, but they're going to have to back up their threats. You're saying that it's going to be an empty threat unless the U.S. gets Saudi Arabia on board, and my understanding is that Saudis are kind of annoyed with the U.S. over Syria.
I mean, that is the whole thing, is that there is no clear strategy. We don't know where we stand on Libya. We don't know where we stand on Syria. We don't know where we stand on Iran. We don't know where we stand on Russia. We try to lecture, countries, and we try to threaten others, or that, but nobody really is paying any attention. I mean, Putin is still, he has his, own plan, and he is basically making all the milestones that he needed to be at, concluded the gas deal in 4 or 5 weeks with China. I mean, that in itself is remarkable. And I guarantee you that all these things have been calculated, that it was not a knee-jerk reaction. He is the guy who is really dictating the tempo of the game. He is the guy who is basically in control. The West is reacting to what he does. The West tried to anticipate what Putin is going to do next. So he's keeping us guessing.
So in other words, he's playing chess and we're playing poker badly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As I said, he doesn't have to have approval from Congress or support from, you know, his political allies like our own president does. He does what he wants.
Well, Fidel Guy, I thank you very much for joining us and for your analysis. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Again, I've been speaking with Fidel Guy, who is the Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company in New York. Mr. Guy has more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research and has previously been with Mobil Oil and JP Morgan Company in New York. He's one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the real scandal in Libya, not the absurd Republican sideshow over Benghazi.
Depends on who. I'm gonna get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. Get you and keep you in my arms evermore. On a faraway
shore. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ali Abdellatif Hamida, who is the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England. He's the author of The Making of Modern Libya, Forgotten Voices, Power and Agency in Colonial and Postcolonial Libya. And his latest book is The Libya We Don't Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Abdellatif Hamida.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be with you again.
And the House is the Democrats on the House have, in the House have just agreed to join in this latest Benghazi panel that they were resisting because it's so much a partisan political issue, and that this whole Benghazi scandal has largely been manufactured by the Republicans. But it is a sideshow and it's a distraction, and frankly, it's a distraction from the reality of what's happening in Libya, isn't it? I mean, shouldn't we be having inquiries into what's happening in Libya?
Yes, indeed. I think what happened in Benghazi was a tragedy. We all agree on that. And I think we need to know more about what happened and all the information that we get to know about the killing of the ambassador and the other American with him there. Unfortunately, there is a bigger tragedy that's, you're quite right, the instability and the violence and the suffering of the Libyan people who paid so much to get rid of the Gaddafi's regime, hoping for a civic democratic republic, and now they're stuck with armed groups and assassinations and extremists elements of jihadi and Salafi background who have been coming to Libya from Afghanistan and Iraq and other places, and they are really holding power because of the barrel of the gun, and the Libyan people have been really disappointed, frustrated in fighting for survival, which is a tragedy, especially everybody was hoping for a new dawn in Libya, a new stable democratic government. And instead of that, Libya looks more and more like a failed state.
Well, at this point, though, in the midst of all this chaos, Libya has set a date for parliamentary elections. At the same time, General Khalifa Haftar seems to be taking on the Islamist militias, including at least according to him, one of the Islamist groups blamed for the attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi. And again, nobody seems to, in the U.S., seems to be focusing on the reality on the ground in Libya. Rather, they are focusing on the political theater of what's going on in Washington in this election year. So give us a sense of what's happening with this general. And he's a fairly enigmatic character. He's been on all kinds of sides of the struggles over the years. He initially fought for Gaddafi and then against him. And then he fought along the, alongside these Islamist rebel groups that he's now bombing.
Yes, very enigmatic. That's a very, very appropriate word, and controversial at the same as well. General Haftar was one of the three officers who belonged to an organization led by Colonel Gaddafi that overthrew the Libyan monarchy in 1969, September 1st, 1969. He is from the central part of the country, from Ishdabia. And he became a major officer in the Libyan army. He was also known for the Libyan commander in the country, the neighboring country of Chad, in the mid-80s, which that army was defeated in a disastrous war. And he was kind of really discredited in that war. And after that, instead of returning to Libya, he joined a Libyan opposition group called the Front for the Salvation of Libya, the National Front for the Salvation of Libya, and took refuge and political asylum in the United States. That group was supported by our own CIA for a while. He lived in exile for a while, and after that, he returned to Libya after the uprising in 2011. He didn't really play a big role because of his background, but he joined the uprising. In February, last February, he tried to, in a TV announcement, he said that he's in charge of a new force trying to fight terrorism and violence. He didn't get anyway. But I think the situation in Libya deteriorated so bad, where people are really insecure about the violence, about the assassination. Just to give you an idea, Ian, 511 officers were assassinated by all kind of shadowy groups. And I called family members and friends, and they told me, I said, what do you think about this general? They told me, we are so desperate. We are fighting for our own lives. If this general can rally people against these really extremist, non-democratic groups that are terrorizing us, we are for it. This is not a matter of luxury or this is a matter of survival. And this is really why we could see there's a lot of support for this general now. It's ironic, Ian, because he has a very controversial background. But it looks like people are saying the enemy of my enemy is now my friend for now. We don't care if he could really rally the people to get rid of the extremists and the jihadists and the assassins, then be it. I'm afraid that also could lead to a protected, maybe a civil war as well. So the situation is very, very, tense and very, very tough now.
Again, I'm speaking with Professor Ali Abdullah Atif Ahmida, who is the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England. He's the author of The Making of Modern Libya, Forgotten Voices, Power and Agency in Colonial and Postcolonial Libya. And his latest book is The Libya We Don't Know. And do you think that this General Khalifa Haftar can organize enough of these the fact that these Islamists have been going around assassinating former military officers, apparently they just go to any building, any business, anybody's house, and they can accuse anybody of being pro-Gaddafi and assassinate them on the spot. And a lot of the Libyan business class and middle class have moved to Tunisia. That's my understanding. The place has been so terrorized by the Islamists, who, by the way, are the same group that killed the U.S. ambassador. So it doesn't sound like anybody is coming to the aid of the average Libyan.
Yes, that's very much the case. And I sense from family members, friends, and people who either call me or get in touch with them through phone or Skype or other means, a vast majority of Libyans are frustrated with NATO, us and the United States and the West. And here is what they say, and I think it carries some weight. They say the West came and helped us in getting rid of regime and destroyed a whole state there, and then left us to our own and allowed the new forces, extremist forces, to take over without helping us rebuild the state, especially the army and the police force. And so there is almost kind of, I wouldn't say conspiracy, but a lot of anger and disappointment. And people are saying time and again, why can't the NATO, the United States, the UN help us rebuild the state since they got it? If you break something, you have to fix it. And that's the mindset that's wrong in Libya. They think right now, this general who emerging at the right time because of the frustration, because of the anger, because of really fear for their lives, they think he is really, we don't care about his background, he's at least is doing the right thing, we're going to ride behind him. There's another point also, Ian. Many of the professional soldiers and policemen, they are joining him because many of them have been killed and targeted, because these groups like Ansar Sharia and others, they want an emirate. They don't want a civic, democratic institutions and state. They say, no, we have to impose our own form of Islam, which is very alien to Libyan modern Islam. And many people in Libya, they see it as really something came to us either from Saudi Arabia or Afghanistan or these groups who most of them are living in the West. They're radicalized and come to impose their will on us.
But the fact that the Saudi Arabians are essentially supporting General Sisi next door in Egypt, and they are obviously, they've been spreading a very reactionary and xenophobic form of Islam around the world for many decades. What can this general expect from his fellow general in Egypt, Sisi? I mean, this general Haftar has set up a self-declared Libyan national army, but he doesn't really have the resources. He may have, the people may be on his side and want to get rid of these Islamists. But are the Egyptians going to help him? Because I'm suspicious of Sisi because of his close ties to Saudi Arabia.
Well, that's a good point. I think we could see that, General Haftar probably... he could see that the example of Egypt is something that could be popular among segments of the population, as in Egypt. But at the same time, it gives some rationale or a copycat, if you like, in this case. The Egyptian army, what we know, is really closing the borders. And what you could see that, and also the Algerian army as well. And you could say that they're trying to close the borders so the Salafist and jihadist groups will not get more arms and more support. So in a way, it's almost blessing this movement. But we have to be very clear. So far, this movement and the tremendous following that is receiving inside Libya for General Haftar is real, because people are telling me, as I indicated to you and your listeners, that we are so desperate now, we need security, we need a national army, we need a police force. Now, whether that's going to happen or not, we don't know. But I think it shows how bad the situation in Libya has reached so far. I think it's fair to say General Sisi and the Algerian state will be very sympathetic to this movement.
Well, but the part about it that I don't understand, and I think your point's well taken, that the U.S. and NATO destroyed that country in order to get rid of Gaddafi, and then they just walked away. And now, is anybody ponying up to help this General Haftar?
Well, I think there is sympathy from within. I would say that the Egyptian state, especially General Sisi and the Egyptian state and the Algerian state, are sympathetic to him. On the other side, however, the Islamists and these jihadist groups, they are supported by Qatar and by Turkey. So you have really regional and international actors intervening in the Libyan arena very much. It's not just an isolated Libyan affair. And I think, is this a worrisome? Yes, it is. But at this stage, if this controversial general and the support that he's generating can lead to establishing some order and allowing election to take place and step down, then it would be great. But if this become protected conflict and the Egyptians and the Qataris and the Turkish state and other regional actors and international jihadist groups would be coming to Libya to fight with their allies there, then Libya could descend into a civil war.
So then this is disturbing, the extent to which outside players are stirring the pot here, particularly Turkey and Qatar. And the Qataris, of course, were involved with that CIA unit there in Benghazi. They were trying to get hold of all of these loose ground-to-air missiles, these so-called MPADs.
Yes.
So, and that was run by the U.S. I'm surprised that, even the Saudi Arabians are now having second thoughts about organizing these jihadis and having them go off and wreak havoc in Syria and now Libya. Is there anybody, do you think, is talking to Turkey and Qatar and pointing out that they're just creating chaos and supporting these sort of criminal takfiris, as they've been referred to?
Well, it's a very complex relationship. I think we'll know more about it later on. What we know for now is Qatar is, because of its tremendous wealth, is an ally of the United States government. There is no secret about that. But that tremendous, rentier revenues from oil and gas allow the Qatari state to play a very, very huge role beyond its capacity and its population. What they are trying to do is through allies, by supporting through arms and money and using the Al Jazeera as well, as international station, as a form, as a soft power for their allies. They're supporting the Muslim Brothers and even some the Libyan fighting Islamic group as well. So there is no secret about it. And Qatar also indicated that they are not in support of a Libyan national army being rebuilt again. So we know that that's the case. It's a very also a very dangerous game, because there's a tremendous backlash against Qatar and its policy. As far as Turkey's policy has always been siding with the Muslim Brothers. So Turkey is in support of the Muslim Brother group in Libya, and they have been trying to, they didn't hide that. So it's very, very much the case. As far as Saudi Arabia, I think Saudi Arabia, while they are not really in support of the Muslim Brothers, but their Wahhabi doctrine, which is very strict, their whole army of clergy and TV stations and missionary activities, they also support a lot of these groups. So they have a really double policy. They are not supporting the Muslim Brothers, but at the same time tolerating other groups as well. And the Qataris and the Saudis are fighting over influence as well. So the picture is a little bit more complex.
Well, it is. And the only people that are absent from the picture that you just portrayed as the United States, who this government is the Obama administration are continually pointing out their great victory in Libya. But it's as if they're trying to pretend that what's happening in Libya today is not as bad as it is.
That's so true. And I think you captured well, Ian. I would say the following. I think the Obama administration did well at the beginning, but then I have to say the lack of a clear policy, the ambiguity in dealing with these people uprising at the beginning became disastrous, quite honestly, because it created a vacuum. And they allowed regional actors who sometimes are not democratic, like the Turkish, the Saudi and the Qataris and other groups, to act as their own deputies or their own agents there. And that lack of clear policy, very, very forceful and very democratic and very much in support of the people uprisings, and being proactive, maybe because of the nightmare and the disasters in Iraq and Afghanistan, that actually, to me, became a big failure in the region. And we have to admit it, and we have to say it as is. The Obama administration, in my opinion, could have done a lot much better. We expected more of it than other administrations, but the record is really very troubling.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Ali Abdellatif Ahmida.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Ali Abdellatif Ahmida, who is the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England. He's the author of The Making of Modern Libya, Forgotten Voices, Power and Agency in Colonial and Postcolonial Libya. And his latest book is The Libya We Don't Know. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the wisdom of the House Democrats' decision to join in the political theater of what will be the eighth investigation into the Benghazi incident. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Waldman, who is a contributing editor for the American Prospect and the author of Being Right Is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Waldman.
Thank you.
And you've been covering the Benghazi scandal, which is an evergreen kept alive largely by the Republicans. I think at this point there may have been up to eight inquiries, at least five that I know of in terms of Senate and House committees. And now they're heading, it looks as though the Democrats, who were thinking about boycotting this special select committee that Boehner has appointed, looks like they're joining it. And so what's your sense? Even they're joining, it's five against seven. Not only is the whole thing, in a sense, stacked against the Democrats, so is the committee itself. So what's your understanding of why they decided to join in?
Well, I guess they thought that it would be better for them to have voices who were on there who could ask the kinds of questions that they want asked and be a counter to the Republicans. And obviously the political risk is that if it was just a partisan Republican enterprise, that it might get much less attention. It's also interesting that the five people that Nancy Pelosi announced that she was going to appoint are among the people who have participated in some of these investigations up until now, and people who are pretty serious members of Congress, some of them on the Armed Services Committee, the Intelligence Committee. And so it isn't she could have appointed people who were sort of more bombastic and do a better job of yelling at the cameras. There were people who wanted Alan Grayson, the congressman from Florida, who often appears on television doing just that. There were people who wanted him to be on the committee, but he was not among the people that she appointed. So it does appear that their court's sort of going to take the high road, if you want to think about it that way, to try to put some serious people on there and be a counter to the Republicans in whatever they whatever they're saying. And it does, you know, I think that most of us who have followed this start with a presumption that there isn't really much more to be found out. But if you look at Trey Gowdy, who is the person who's going to be leading the committee, he is a former prosecutor, and it's interesting, if you go to YouTube, there's all kinds of videos of him sort of shouting at witnesses in congressional hearings, and this is obviously something that has made him very popular with a certain kind of conservative who likes to see Obama administration officials get yelled at by a Republican. And, you know, he's already talked about how this as a trial, as though he's a prosecutor and not someone whose job is to investigate and uncover the truth, but to convict the person on the other side. So, you know, I am skeptical that anything new is going to come out of this that we haven't already found out from all of the committees that have come before, and it's going to be mostly a media event.
Well, it seems, Paul Waldman, that the fact that Nancy Pelosi is, I think one of the only statements I can recall that she's really made, or at least the sound bites that came out of her comments regarding whether or not to join this committee, was that she sort of said that Darrell Issa had become damaged goods and they were merely moving it to some other venue under Trey Gowdy. And so would that be connected to her choice of having the ranking Democrat on the committee, Representative Elijah Cummings, who's, of course, been the ranking member on the Oversight and Government Reform Committee that Darrell Issa chairs, and he himself has been a victim of Darrell Issa's grandstanding and cutting off the microphone and those kind of theatrics and bullying, which the Democrats were afraid this committee would engage in.
Yeah, it may be. You know, I assume that the people that she picked are those who she thinks, you know, already have a good base of knowledge about this matter and are going to be able to stand up to that sort of thing. And it's true that Darrell Issa is damaged goods. I mean, if I were a Republican and I watched the last couple of years as he has been sort of the Obama administration's chief prosecutor, I would be pretty disappointed because he's really been just unbelievably incompetent about it. Every time he, you know, says leaks something to the press that there's going to be some dramatic revelation, it turns out that there is no dramatic revelation. He keeps trying to pin something on them, and nothing ever seems to stick. And so, you know, it's not really surprising that this thing, which is frankly really important to the Republican base, is getting turned over to someone else. And I think that's a lot of what's going on here. You know, they need to sort of keep feeding this beast of their own base that demands that, you know, that something be done to get the Obama administration, even if they can't quite find the impeachable offense. And Benghazi has been built up into this thing that's so incredibly important to a lot of those extremely conservative Republicans, that it's something that they just kind of have to keep hitting on, even if I'm sure if you could actually get them to be candid, there aren't very many Republicans in Congress who actually think there's anything there, that yes, it was a terrible tragedy, and yes, there are lessons that can be learned about security at embassies and consulates, but, you know, the malfeasance, the criminal behavior that they were hoping they would find, it just didn't happen. And so the worst thing that they can say is that there were talking points that were released that may not have, you know, may have been a little misleading, and, you know, that's the crime, the talking points. It's sort of absurd. But they've built it up into something where they cannot deny their base, you know, the more talk about Benghazi and more hearings, and so if nothing else, this will serve to sort of keep them at bay.
Again, I'm speaking with Paul Waldman, who's a contributing editor for The American Prospect and the author of Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. So the fact that that they've I mean, the subtext has often been suggested, and I don't think it's anything of a stretch to recognize that this is also this jihad over this Republican jihad over Benghazi is also an effort to dirty up Hillary Clinton, who is likely to be the Democratic nominee in 2016 for president. And to that extent, I'm kind of astounded at what they're doing, because there is a real scandal in Libya. You know, NATO and the United States bombed the hell out of that country to get rid of Gaddafi, and then they just walked away and left it in chaos. And now we are at a point now where it's poised on the brink of civil war, with a general trying to organize a Libyan national army, which was decimated.
by NATO and the U.S. There were no army left in place. There was no police left in place. The Islamist militias took over, and they were the very militias that were involved in killing the ambassador and the SEALs in Benghazi. And this general is actually bombed the very militia, Islamist militia group that have been blamed for the attack. But they're not getting any help from anywhere. In fact, the jihadis are getting help from Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia. So to my mind, that's the real scandal. And yet they're focusing on this dead-end cul-de-sac, beating a dead horse over Benghazi, when they could really make a strong case against the United States and, by extension, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, you would think, and I'm sure that most Republicans in Congress don't even know the barest facts about what's actually going on there. You know, this is the road that they went down, and they're convinced sincerely that President Obama and Hillary Clinton and everyone who works for them are corrupt to the core. And if they just keep looking, they will find some kind of smoking gun that shows how corrupt they really are. And so to, you know, undertake some kind of a complex investigation of conditions there now, where they might have to say what they might have done in the circumstances, that's something that I think is probably doesn't have a lot of appeal for Republicans in Congress. So, as you said, they're just going to keep beating this dead horse because it's the horse that's right in front of them.
Well, but it seems like they can't tell the difference between government incompetence and government conspiracy.
Yeah, I think you're right when it comes to a government that they don't like. And, you know, this is something that I think we're all prone to a certain extent, that we look at the people from the other party, people who we disagree with, and say that their motives must always be bad, that if something went wrong, it could only have been from something sinister that they did. You know, it's a version of what they call the fundamental attribution error. You know, which says that, you know, if I cut someone off in traffic, it was because I just made a mistake or didn't see them. Whereas if I see someone else cut someone off in traffic, I think it's because they're just inherently bad people, and that's why they did that. And there's something similar that happens in politics where, you know, we look at the administration of the other party and think that everything that they do is sinister, and they have evil intentions for all of their actions. And if something goes wrong, it can only be because of some sort of criminal malfeasance on the part of those people whom we dislike so much. Whereas when the same things happen in an administration of our own party, the people that we like, you know, we are willing to grant that it was a mistake, or that they weren't trying to do something awful, but things just went wrong. And I think that in this case, Republicans are so convinced that President Obama and Hillary Clinton, whom, you know, they've hated for 20 years, that they're so morally corrupt that there must be something there, and if they just keep digging, that they'll uncover it.
So, what's your sense then, Paul Wolman, of this how this committee is going to proceed under the chairmanship of Trey Gowdy, who is a former prosecutor and has already indicated that he thinks that there's a real smoking gun? One of the most amusing lines I ever heard was after this last email was discovered that involved talking points, just standard operating procedure for the National Security Council's giving the talking points to a government official about to meet the press. But they've managed to, they came forth and said, this is the closest thing we have to a smoking gun. So presumably Gowdy will be getting closer and closer to the smoking gun, whether in reality or in his imagination. But will he be as much of a bully as ISA? In other words, my understanding is that they don't have a deal where both the Democrats and the Republicans have to sign off on subpoenas. The Republicans can therefore ambush the Democrats with witnesses. So are they, walking into a line stand, even though you've got really good people on this, including a decorated American war veteran, Tammy Duckworth? At the same time, if the deck is stacked against you and the game is rigged, you're not going to come out looking too good.
Well, ultimately, it's going to be a matter of what kind of evidence there is and what they actually uncover. And, you know, they can issue all the subpoenas that they like, but if they can't come up with anything that anybody did wrong, then they're not going to be able to, you know, mount the kind of case that they want. And so I imagine what's going to happen is that for the first couple of times that they hold these hearings, it's going to get a lot of attention and people are going to look at it and see that there's really not much there. Now, it's always possible that they'll uncover something horrible that somebody did. That, you know, they used to think that there was a stand-down order, that someone was told not to go and save the people there, and that turned out not to have never happened. But maybe there is something there. Who knows? But everything that we know up until now suggests that there isn't, and I think that after a couple of these sessions where there is no smoking gun, there's no dramatic revelation, people are going to stop paying attention and it's going to kind of fizzle out. And that would be my prediction as to what will happen.
So in terms of the Democrats making this decision, do you think, can you predict one way or the other, Paul, whether or not they would have made a stronger case by just boycotting it and isolating them and making it look like, you know, a partisan sort of debating society talking to themselves?
Yeah, I think you probably could have said strategically that would have been better, assuming that nothing comes out. I think if there is something important that we learn, and the Democrats had boycotted, then they would be the ones who would look unreasonable and partisan. But if there's nothing there, then you know there doesn't seem to be much reason to participate. But you know, it's possible that if we assume, let's say that it does end up sort of fizzling out, the Democrats can say, you know, we gave it a shot, we put serious people on there, and we tried to participate to the best we could, and what came out of it was nothing. And so at least they look like they took the high road and, you know, tried to do the best job that they could of being as accommodating as possible. And that may be what ends up happening in the end.
Well, I just wonder, though, whether this, as I mentioned earlier, whether Trey Gowdy is going to be like ISA, where, you know, he cuts off their mics, he stacks the decks, he rigs it so that he blindsides them as often as he can because they don't have subpoena power, etc. I mean, that, you know, there's a certain zealotry that's amongst these people, and he comes out of that Tea Party wing. I don't know whether he's motivated in the same way that ISA is. I think ISA is more of an ambitious politician into grandstanding. But this other guy, Gowdy, seems to be a true believer. So I guess it remains to be seen how rampantly partisan he's going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, ultimately, I think, as I said, the facts are going to be what dictate it. And if there's anything there to grandstand about, then that'll be meaningful. And if there's nothing and it's just sort of empty grandstanding, then, you know, that will become clear as well.
Well, Paul Waldman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Waldman, who's a contributing editor for The American Prospect and the author of Being Right Is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time one night in America.